Ordinary Days, which is a series of short reflections, really, that are very readable on the tube train or the bus or the loo. I hope you enjoy it if you manage to get a copy. They're available in the tent. The talk, really, this morning is an extrapolation or an expansion of one of the chapters in the book called Rumours of Glory, which I'll be actually reading a fair bit of as part of what I'm saying here. But basically, we're grappling with such questions as, are we more likely to run into God outside of the churches than in them? Are there secular epiphanies, non-religious revelations of the divine? Where are we most likely to run into God? In prayer meetings or church services or watching a football match? Depends who you're watching. Viewing a film or making love? I certainly know that in the latter one, people often cry out to God in the middle of it. Can we run into God in and with people of other faiths or in people of no faith? Is the Christian God too small, too tribalistic? I'll read you some verses from the Bible, which I don't always start my seminars with, but it's Isaiah chapter 6, in which it says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lofty, and the hem of his robe filled the temple. Seraphs were in attendance above him. Each had six wings. With two they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they flew. And one called to another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. The pivots on the threshold shook at the voices of those who called, and the house filled with smoke. And I said, woe is me, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Yet my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. There's a friend of mine who I've known for many years, who's quite a well-known preacher, Christian speaker in this country, and he went through quite a difficult time at one point and dropped out of the sort of scene for some time and kind of reconstructed his faith during that period. And after that, he was invited to speak at another large Christian event in this country, which I won't mention. It just tell you that it happens in the springtime. And he was speaking to one of the sort of leading figures there beforehand who was saying, so what are you going to preach about today? So he said, what I'm going to say is that the whole earth is full of God's glory. And I'm going to say that God isn't just present in church or in Christian worship, but that God is present in the whole world, in life outside of church. And he began to sort of, you know, hold forth a little bit. And the other guy sort of intervened and said, just hang on a minute, I think you may be going into dangerous territory here. You know, I think people are maybe going to think that you've gone liberal for preaching the Bible. He said, and if people think you've gone liberal, then you won't anymore be seen as a kind of proper evangelical. And if you're not seen as proper evangelical, then doors are going to close to you and, you know, so on and so forth. To which he gave, I think, the memorable reply, I don't really give a monkey's. The whole earth is full of God's glory, is what the angels said, and that's what we're really looking at. You can run into God, you can bump into God, you can catch glimpses of God just about anywhere and everywhere. There's a story about a man who was confined to a prison cell. His only view to the outside world was through a small window high up on the wall. To begin with, he hated being stuck in there and despised the miserable view that he had on the outside world, which was the only world that he knew about and believed in. It was also the world for which he longed. But time passed, and that little window eventually became his friend. It offered tiny morsels of life, a wisp of cloud, a free-flying bird, a passing plane, a falling leaf, a raindrop, a snowflake. But he gradually came to see that this was not such a bad thing. It forced him to concentrate on the particular and to imagine a lot from a little. Indeed, he was amazed at discovering how much of life he found in one small sample. At times, the view from the window was shallow and opaque. The world seemed to end at the window. But at other times, the window opened onto a blue and empty sky. Then it gave him access to infinity. And he felt an awakening within him, an awakening of transcendent longings that he'd never really felt before or knew were there. The little window offered glimpses of heaven as well as of earth. And when eventually the man was released, he found himself seeing everything in general and nothing in particular. And to his dismay, the sense of beyond that he caught sight of through the little window, the stirrings of a transcendent dimension of life, now began to diminish. Paradoxically, it seems that the sense of the transcendent is linked to an appreciation of the particular. I don't suppose that you could call Isaiah's window little. He had something much more like a multi-screen panoramic view of God. I saw the Lord sitting on a high and lofty throne, surrounded by angels. And he heard this relentless angelic conversation. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. Now, I really like that, the whole earth being full of God's glory. What a massive, inclusive vision that is. Not the church full of God's glory, not St. Paul's Cathedral full of God's glory, not St. Peter's in Rome full of God's glory, but the whole earth is full of God's glory. Sadly, few of us see it that way. We look out on grey mornings and see drizzly rain. We sit in lines of traffic or stand half asleep on a jam-packed tube. We watch the news and see more burned out buses in Israel, more crying babies in the aftermath of an explosion. We drudge our way through yet another daily round, dispose of another dirty nappy, bag our rubbish, find ourselves caught up in yet another grouchy exchange with a loved one. The whole earth is full of God's glory, we wish. And yet the little windows on the transcendent are still there, if only we can lift our eyes to see them. And I'm really taken with this idea that the way we encounter the transcendent is by concentrating on the particular. And that's another way of saying that God is found most profoundly in ordinary things in life, the things that we most take for granted, which is one of my favourite themes in many of the things that I say. In a wonderful book called Mystical Passion, Spirituality for a Bored Society, good title, William McNamara says that it's better to stay home and smell a flower, bake an apple pie, or sweep a floor than to have a spooky, spurious religious experience at a prayer meeting. Go with that. It's better to simply enjoy the sunshine or a good show than to meddle curiously and conceitedly with the occult. It's better to romp with the dogs in the backyard than engage in a haughty, spiritual conversation at church, if the dogs in the yard help us to be less egotistical and more God-centered, which mine definitely does. This is my kind of spirituality, folks. How can we relish the higher things of God if we can't simply enjoy little things like a glass of beer, which we can have here now? Real ale. We've grown up. If we can't enjoy these simple little things like a boat ride, a warm bath, a good kiss, a belly laugh, smelling the air after a shower of rain, lying in the sun gazing into the soft brown eyes of a furry creature. All these things. Hey, whatever turns you on. All these things can be rumours, rumours of glory, tiny windows on the great beyond. Take the film American Beauty, which I hope you've all seen. If you haven't, make sure you do. It's a fascinating delve into the modern American psyche, based around the story of Lester, the archetypal Mr. Suburbia, who's trying to regain his youth. In one beautifully shot scene, and it's the one that you'll remember if you've seen the film, Lester's daughter is with Ricky, her boyfriend, who says he wants to show her the most beautiful thing that he ever found. It's a short film portraying a plastic bag being blown around by the wind, just minutes before a snowstorm. The image of the swirling bag, if you've seen it, you'll know, is absolutely spellbinding. Ricky says, "This bag was just dancing with me, like a little kid begging me to play with it." He goes on to say that sitting watching the bag, he realized that there is this entire life behind things, and this incredibly benevolent force that wanted him to know that there was no reason to be afraid, ever. The whole earth is full of God's glory. St. Paul says, "In him we live and move and have our being." Sometimes, Ricky says, "I feel there's so much beauty in the world, I just can't take it. And my heart is just going to cave in." Well, I know what he means, and I hope you do too. But on the few occasions that I've felt like that, it's always been in response to something very particular. You know, the little plastic bag is a metaphor for so many little particularities of life. Tiny windows on God, rumors of glory. I felt it when I fell in love with my wife, Pat. In fact, I fell in love with her so much that I proposed to her on the third time I met her. 37 years later, here we are. I felt it again when I watched two of my three children entering this world and then held them in my arms. Minute and yet perfectly formed scraps of humanity, windows on God, rumors of glory. It's amazing how many people's lives are transformed when they have a baby. In my church, they seem to have them almost every week, actually. Something in the water, they say. Just recently, I was listening to some people calling in Five Live, Radio Five Live, to talk about parenthood. And it was particularly moving to hear guys who had worked in highly paid jobs in the city, who'd given it all up to stay at home and look after their small children. Their whole value system and priorities have been turned upside down by becoming a parent. The transcendent made visible through a tiny window. The Christian doctrine of the Holy Trinity springs out of a glorious affirmation that God is both beyond creation and revealed within it. In theological terms, we say God is transcendent and immanent, present within creation. Jesus Christ is God's beyond, come among us. In him we get the clearest glimpse of what God is like. The tragedy is that we've all too often tried to contain Jesus within the church, in doctrines, in the structures of formal religion, in theological formulas. We've invoked his name to oppress those who don't fit our mold, to exclude those who we don't like or don't believe the same things as us or who don't behave in quite the same way. But God won't be tied down. You'll find him in the most unlikely places, hiding in a barn in ancient Palestine, smiling from the face of a baby in a supermarket, suffering in the broken bodies of AIDS sufferers, twinkling in the eye of an elderly woman about to slip away with dementia, grinning in the midst of a storm, serving us through the mundane acts of kindness by a loved one whom we invariably take for granted. These and many more things could be and are our little windows on God, our rumours of glory. They tell us that there's something more than just all of this ordinary stuff. The ordinary is actually the sacrament of the divine. It's amazing how much of God can be found in one small sample of life. Now, this is a very different window that I've just been describing to the world, to the one that we are shown very often in churches. Often Christians see the world simply as enemy territory. People who non-churchgoers are seen as the unsaved, who are on their way to hell, and any goodness shown by them is just a manifestation of good works, doesn't count with God at all. So how can we discern God outside the church? What criteria do we use to judge whether God's Spirit is present in the world or among non-Christians? Well, Jesus clearly taught that it is not a matter of labels. It's not a matter of religious orthodoxy. He said that we should judge people by their fruits. By their fruits you will know them, not by whether they tick all the right boxes on a theological sheet or whether they can say that they believe the Bible from cover to cover, including the maps. Paul enlarges on the point He contrasts in Galatians the works of the flesh, which he says are very, very obvious. Fornication, impurity, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, enmities, strife, jealousy, anger, quarrels, dissensions, factions, envy, drunkenness, carousing, etc. I don't even know what some of those things are, but they're obvious, Paul says. They must be to those who do them. But he contrasts these works of the flesh, which I don't think was intended to be a complete list, with the fruit of the Spirit, which he says can be seen in things like love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. That's really an expansion, isn't it, on Jesus saying, by their fruits you shall know them. And then in Philippians 4:8, Paul says that the God of peace is seen in, and I quote, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is pleasing, whatever is commendable. If there is any excellence, and if there is anything worthy of praise, he says, think about these things. Or another translation says, take account of these things. And the sad thing is that very often these things are not taken account of. As I say, it's just dead works by people who don't know God. There's a lovely new translation of the Bible. I don't know if it's in the tent. I haven't looked entirely around there, but it's called Good as New, the Good as New translation. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's really great. I mean, it's obviously a very free sort of interpretation of the Bible with, and its subtitle is A Radical Retelling of the Scriptures. And it's got an interesting range of people commending it on the back, including our own beloved Tony Campolo, who says that it helped him, or it showed him that he'd had to rethink the whole of his sort of Christian faith. The Good as New translation of that verse in Philippians I've just quoted says this: there are plenty of good things in this world for you to appreciate and enjoy. There are many forms of truth, many causes that deserve support, campaigns for justice, societies with a good name, projects that benefit the community. These are the things you ought to be interested in. So let me tell you some stories of God's goodness, beauty, and justice outside of the church, which in which I've personally run into God. As most of you know, I'm now a vicar in the Church of England. I'm vicar of St. Luke's, Holloway in North London. And I've been sort of dropped, having been in Christian leadership for most of my adult life, but in a different context altogether. I've suddenly been dropped into what it is to be a parish priest, not just to be a leader of a congregation who come into church on Sundays, but to be a priest to the community. And I have to say that I've taken to it rather well. I find that it's just like it's all there on a plate. The Church of England, for all its flaws and problems, and it has a privileged position in this community still. It's one which is fading and which is eroding away, but it's still there if we're prepared to take advantage of it. And it always shocks me that many of my evangelical colleagues in the Church of England shy away from, not all, but some shy away from the things like, you know, baptizing people's babies if they don't come to church, marrying people and taking funerals and so on and so forth, because they're too busy with evangelism. But I find I'm bumping into people all the time. I'm bumping into God in people all the time. Take Kay. Kay is a woman in her mid to late 40s, I would guess. She lives on the Market Estate, which is a really kind of rough estate in my parish. And it's got so many problems and so many difficulties. I've taken the funerals of old people, gone to see their partners, who I find are just terrified to even walk out of their front door onto the corridor in their block of flats. And they're locked up. And I think, what a devastating tragedy this is, having lived for 75, 80 years of their life, moving into these flats in the 60s, which they thought was going to be absolute paradise. This was their little heaven. And to think that they're ending their lives being imprisoned, in this little flat for fear of what's going to happen to them outside. Kay is a shining light in this community. She doesn't come to church. I don't expect she'll come to church next week or next year. She may turn up sometime, and I'll be glad to see her if she does. But I don't care. I've bumped into God in Kay. I think God lives in her. I went to take the funeral of a man on the estate. He just lives a few doors away from her. This was a man in his mid-50s who they think came from Scotland because he had a bit of a Scottish accent and he liked to wear a little tartan cap with a bobble on top, you know. But nobody knew much about him except he was very loved in the community. Everybody liked him a lot. And he used to always come to Kay's for Sunday dinner with their family. He had no family. Nobody knew of a single family member of his in the entire world. He was just this little man who lived on this estate who Kay took him for Sunday dinners. Whatever is commendable. And sadly, he died and left nothing. He had no money. He had no belongings worth talking about. He was really a pauper. And he would have been buried in a common grave because no one could pay for his funeral. Kay was never going to have that. She wasn't going to have him in a common grave. And so what did she do? Without telling anybody, I didn't know about this at the time, she took out a loan. At quite high rates, actually, for 3 years to pay £2,000 or £1,500, I think it was, for this guy's funeral. She was going to pay for this for 3 years, and she's broke. She's got no money. She's got grandchildren, and, you know, they're all hanging out. And she's just one of these wonderful maternal sort of figures. And so she paid for this man's funeral. Whatever is worthy of praise. Take account of these things. I think God takes account of Kay and Kay's love for the people around about her. Thankfully, when I told a few friends about this, they very quickly dipped into their more padded wallets and pulled out the money to pay off Kay's debt, which was great. And then there's Gary. I met him through a funeral too, actually. It's part of my life, I'm afraid. But Gary is a caretaker of one of the little housing estates close to the church. And I went to take a funeral of a man there. And he had similarly no family, nobody around. Gary was his sort of executor. The caretaker was his executor who was looking after things. And Gary did a great job. He organized this funeral wonderfully. And we were there in the crematorium, me and Gary, Gary's wife, Gary's little baby of about two, who I'm actually baptizing in a couple of weeks, in a pushchair. Oh, and Gary's mother-in-law. That was the congregation. And I was so moved by this, you know, and I just felt I was running into God in the crematorium, seeing that there are people. I mean, maybe Gary, it was his job and maybe he would do it. But, you know, his wife, his little kid, his mother-in-law. I just think this is better than I have often seen in churches. And when just before I pressed the button for the coffin to disappear, Gary went forward to the coffin and planted a kiss on the coffin. Well, I was fighting back the tears myself. Whatsoever is honourable, take account of this. Or look at Live 8, you know, which we've all seen and been a part of, I hope, over these recent times. Make poverty history, which is the theme of Greenbelt here today. Inspiring initiatives on behalf of the poor and the oppressed and the forgotten. Not specifically Christian, though thankfully, I think in many ways coming out of a Christian kind of source somewhere down there. But, you know, that really doesn't entirely matter because, you know, Live 8, Make Poverty History, these sort of initiatives are expressing the heart of God so eloquently. Whatsoever is just and worthy of praise, take account of this. On the telly just recently, back home on the London area news, I was watching a story about a rabbi, Jewish rabbi, and an imam, a Muslim imam, who had met up and become friends in Tottenham. And the film was about them going around each of their separate communities and introducing the other to their communities. And it was very moving, you know, seeing these two people, two communities who are so alienated, so isolated in many ways, and who are the centre of so much conflict in our world in the Middle East at the moment. And to see these two guys going round and just making them make friends. And they were sitting down, you know, in cafes around Tottenham and different places and just chatting and talking. And you just felt, gosh, this is the kingdom of God at work here. I'm running into God here. God is at work. Connections are being made. Barriers are being broken down. The kingdom of God's love and justice and reconciliation is breaking in through two men, neither of whom share the same faith that I do, but in whom I recognize my God at work. There was a story a little while back in the news, actually, of a guy called Johnny Jessner, who was a 19-year-old Scottish Jewish student, who you might have seen it in the news. He was visiting Israel, where he was hoping to go and study medicine. He had the misfortune to be on a bus that was blown up by a suicide bomber, and he was one of six Jews who were killed. A 19-year-old life that was just blasted away there, along with those others. But the great thing about this story was that Johnny's mother and father, who had no relationships with Palestinian people at all, who had no friends who were Palestinians, in fact, who had really serious kind of misgivings about Palestinian people, agreed when the doctor asked if Johnny's kidney could be donated to a seven-year-old Muslim girl who desperately needed a new kidney. And it is just the most tremendous story. And I remember watching the a documentary that was made as a follow-up of it, where Johnny's mum felt that she had to go and see the little girl who had her Johnny's kidney in her. And she went through this tortuous journey, realizing what it's like for Palestinians to cross over, you know, through the gate to go into the Gaza Strip, I think it was, and to go and visit. And she felt the pain. And she was talking all the time. It was a kind of one of those kind of commentary sort of programs in which she was expressing her fears and her doubts and all the rest of it. But she went through with it, and she went, and she ends up in this little, very humble abode, meeting this family, the father of whom had a little kind of coffee bar on the corner of the street. And she met this beautiful little girl, you know, who had part of her son in her. And it was just great to see these two women who didn't speak the same language, but whose whole body language and eyes were just sort of communicating so eloquently a sense of identification with one another. And the little girl, Yasmin's mother, said through the translator, "I'm so thankful, and I'm going to treasure the fact that your son is in my daughter." Running into God, it's a long way from church. It's even a long way from Christianity, but God is there. The whole earth is full of God's glory. The fruit of God's loving spirit is clearly seen in each of these stories. There's a great danger in making dogma, doctrine, belief, the criteria for judging whether God is present in people or in situations. And that's not, I don't say that because dogma, doctrine and belief is unimportant to me. Anyone who knows anything about me knows that they're supremely important to me. I spend my life studying, reading, thinking, working through and trying to write about the things that I believe most passionately about. But I'm not under the illusion that the dogma, the doctrine, the beliefs, the Christianity that is so precious and so intrinsic to all that I am can ever possibly contain the God whose glory is in the whole earth. God is greater and bigger. One of the most radical statements in the New Testament is one that is the opening sentence to the wedding service. Every time I take a wedding, I begin, the very first thing I do is to say these words from John's epistle. God is love. And those who live in love live in God, and God lives in them. That's fantastic, isn't it? I'm so glad that's in the Bible. I can say, this is what I believe, and it's in the Bible. God is love, and those who live in love live in God, and God lives in them. God is revealed in and through the Christian message, but God is bigger than Christianity. The book of Amos is all about this, actually. It's all about Israel's mistaken belief that they alone were God's chosen people. And I dare you to go away and read it in the light of that understanding, that this is a book that's all about Israel's mistaken belief that they alone were God's chosen people. They made the mistaken link between believing that Yahweh, God, was the true and only God, and imagining that they were Yahweh's only people. That's the mistake that they made. Walter Brueggemann, the great Old Testament scholar, argues that this cozy, self-congratulatory assumption on the part of Israel, along with a certain religious self-indulgence, is the major concern that Amos is addressing in his prophecy in that book. Brueggemann says, the problem Amos addressed is not that the Israelites did not believe in Yahweh, but that they believe too much. They believe not only that Yahweh alone is God, but also that Israel alone is Yahweh's people. A consequence of this ideological linkage, he says, is that Israel became self-satisfied in its ethics and in its worship, so that its very orthodoxy became a warrant for self-indulgence. To the Israelite listener at the time, the challenge and crux of Amos's message is distilled in two questions that God asks through Amos in Amos 9, verse 7. And this is what God asks. He says to the people of Israel, "Are you not like the Ethiopians to me, O people of Israel?" says the Lord. I think the answer that everyone wanted to give was, "No, we're not like the Ethiopians." And yet the whole implication of the question is, "Yes, you are. Are you not like the Ethiopians to me, O people of Israel?" says the Lord. "Did I not bring Israel up from the land of Egypt?" Yeah, we're all for that. "And did I not also bring the Philistines from Kaphtor and the Arameans from Kir?" Gosh, that's a very radical comment there, or question, in its implications. The question is shocking from an Israelite perspective. The prospect that there are other narratives, that their narrative of being led out of captivity in Egypt is not necessarily the only narrative of God's activities in the world. Can God be working beyond our faith is what is suddenly being posed to the Israelite people. Needless to say, it's the same question that's there in the Bible for us to ask about our own faith. The prophet Amos, Brueggemann says, by his ideology-shattering rhetorical questions, invites us to imagine that these two traditional enemies of Israel, the Philistines and the Arameans, have a history with Yahweh not unlike Israel's history with Yahweh, even though that history is not known to Israel. I mean, it kind of puts the whole present Middle East kind of issue into a context, doesn't it? That I know many of us here at Greenbelt are committed to anyway, the belief that God has a narrative of activity with the Palestinian people as well as with the Jewish people. And that this sort of melting pot, this sort of painful crossroads between the three great Abrahamic religions in the Middle East of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism is not an account of one people who are the real and only people of God, others who are kind of, well, they've been a bit rejected, but they're going to come back in again, and others who, well, forget them. They've got nothing to do with this. But instead, this word of Amos opens up perhaps the thought that what we have here is a painful crossover of three narratives, which will represent all the pain and difficulty of disobeying God, of rebelling against God, of turning one's back on God, but also of people coming from different directions who are hearing God and working with God, but not necessarily hearing each other. Amos 9:7 introduces a kind of radical pluralism, if you like, that subverts Israel's self-confident monofaith. The of the question, are they not like you? That to me of the question means that Yahweh stands outside of the cozy reductions of certitude and confidence that marked Israel's theopolitics, their whole kind of outlook. Something is being shaken up at a very, very fundamental and radical level here. Brueggemann says that according to this verse 7 in chapter 9, no single salvation history, no fixed line of God's mighty deeds, for such mighty deeds happen in many places, many of which are beyond the purview of Israel's orthodoxy. The call of God to the people of Israel back in Exodus was a call on a people who groaned under their slavery, under their bondage. They groaned and they cried out. If you look in Exodus, you'll see that it doesn't say they cried out to God, to Yahweh. They just cried out. They cried out in their pain and in their oppression, in their slavery, in their injustice. They just cried out. But what does it say? It says God heard their cry. And through that, Moses came, and the narrative of God working with the children of Israel began. I think that Amos 9:7 reminds us that God hears the groans and cries of many peoples in the world, living in zones of abuse and injustice. God is attentive to the cry of the oppressed. And whether it is a whole community of people, or whether it is, you know, just some poor lost soul stuck in a flat in North London, God hears the cries of people who are destitute, who are lonely, who are oppressed. And God, in so many different ways, meets people in their pain and in their anguish. Brueggemann points out that, moreover, this action of Yahweh, from what we have in this utterance, did not convert these people to Yahwism, did not require them to speak Hebrew, did not submerge their histories as subsets of Israel's history. In other words, you know, the fact that God says in this passage that he also worked in the lives and the history of the Philistines and the Aramaeans, from what we have in the record, doesn't lead to them becoming Yahwists, or, you know, being part of the Jewish people. They still carried on being who they were, and yet God, it seems, had worked in them and through them. What does that suggest for God working in our world today? There is a deep, dense otherness to God in human history, which, folks, we ignore to our peril. As soon as we feel we own God, we've got God, this is our God, and nobody else is God, we are stepping into very, very dangerous territory. And that's precisely what Amos was dealing with in Israel at the time. We soon fall into the mentality where doubts and questions are excluded, and we simply assume that this is how it is. We are right, they are wrong. We have the truth, they don't. God is on our side. And as Bob Dylan says, you never ask questions when God's on your side. You know the song, don't you? It's worth listening to. I'm sure you've, in your time, many of you read C.S. Lewis's series of Narnia books, and you may be familiar with that little piece in The Last Battle, in which Lewis, it seems to me, speculates on what God's arrangements may be for people of other religions through the form of this fantasy narrative of the stories of Narnia that he tells. In the last days of Narnia, after the last battle had been fought, we meet in the book Emeth, who is the young Carlemine prince. Emeth hated the name of Aslan, the true ruler of Narnia, who was, of course, the great lion, and worshipped the false god, Tash. And in the afterlife, Emeth entered the heavenly stable expecting to meet Tash. Instead, he found himself in the kingdom of Aslan, and he was greeted not by Tash, but by the great lion himself. And this is how he relates what happened then. The glorious one bent down his golden head and touched my forehead with his tongue and said, "Son, thou art welcome." But I said, "Alas, Lord, I am no son of thine, but the servant of Tash." He answered, "Child, all the service thou hast done to Tash, I account as service done to me. No service which is vile can be done to me, and none which is not vile can be done to him. Therefore, if any man swear by Tash and keep his oath for the oath's sake, it is by me that he has truly sworn, though he knew it not, and it is I who will reward him. And if any man do a cruelty in my name, then though he says the name Aslan, it is Tash whom he serves, and by Tash his deeds are accepted." But I said, "I have been seeking Tash all my days." "Beloved," said the glorious one, "unless thy desire had been for me, thou wouldst not have sought so long and truly, for all who all find what they truly seek." At the end of the day, it comes down to, I guess, the sort of God that you believe in. What I'm describing, in a way, is my gospel. It's the God I believe in. I can't go for the sectarian, tribal God, the narrow-minded deity who demands that we all tick the same boxes and all sign up for the same statement of faith. I've been there in the past, but I'm not there anymore. God has to be bigger than that. I mean, I'm bigger than that. God has to be bigger than that. I'm just tiny little Dave Tomlinson. I could come up with a better way of judging the world than simply sort of piling everyone over there because they were born in this world into this particular background and shoving all the rest over there because they were... I mean, come on. God has to be better than that. I mean, we just have to look at creation. What incredible diversity there is in creation. Do you know that the Amazon rainforest contains at least 1,600 species of birds alone and about 1 million different kinds of insect? I read recently that the world produces no fewer than 11,000 different types of beans, every one of them available fairly traded. And why? Why does God create 11,000 different types of beans and 1,600 birds in the Amazon? Well, because God clearly revels in diversity. And at our peril, we narrow him down and say, this is God. We've got him in this little box. This is what he's like. This is how he behaves. This is how he's going to treat other people. This is how... Forget it. God is bigger. God has so much greater diversity. I don't have to decide, finally, who God includes in and who God might exclude. I like it when great German theologian Jürgen Moltmann was asked whether he was a universalist, and he said, sadly not, but I suspect God is. I don't have to determine who's in, who's out. I don't have to dictate who God hangs out with. God will decide that all on his own. I just know and I believe that the whole earth is full of God's glory. We can run into him in the most unexpected places, in the most surprising people, in the most unpredictable circumstances. The really important thing is to keep an eye out for God. Don't try to contain or domesticate him, or worst of all, imagine that you and your pals have a monopoly on his presence or his blessing. God is that great benevolent presence at the heart of the universe. Unlimited, unconstrained, uncontainable, untamable. Blessed be God. To him be glory now and forever. Amen. That's me done.